Thank you. Good morning. I call this meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is just after 11:30 this morning. Present today are Senator Coghill, Senator Hughes, Senator Wilikowski, Co-Chair Costello, Representative Fansler, Representative Ledoux, Representative Reinbold, Representative Tarr, our public member, Chief Warrant Officer retired Jerry Beasley, public member Colonel retired Tim Jones, public member Brigadier General retired Julio Banez, and myself, Co-Chair Kawasaki. Also in the room with us today, we have a number of members of the House, Representative Parrish, Representative Tallarico, and Representative Sadler. Thank you for joining us this morning. We also have three public members who are were unable to make the trip journey here. We have Nelson Angapak, Colonel retired George Vicalis, and Charles Chick Wallace, the civilian aide to the Secretary of the Army. I believe all three of those members are online. Before we begin, I just want to remind members to silence your cell phones. This is the first meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee, and I just wanted to introduce my aide, Mercedes Colbert behind me, stalking me from behind. I also have in the room with me Ashley Strauch, who will be assisting in the delivery. As a reminder, new people in the room, if you have any notes that you'd like to pass to committee members, please pass them formally through through Ashley in the front. Due to a limited time today, I'd like to remind members that questions for each of the commanders will be limited to about 5 minutes. Any remaining questions should be directed through the co-chair of my office so that we can make answers to those questions available to all members of this committee. I'd also like to remind members, remind the public that the co-chair and Costello and I will be hosting a media availability shortly after with the commanders. It'll be in the speaker's chamber on the second floor at 1:15 today after adjourning. You're welcome to attend to listen in as the Capitol Press Corps and commanders ask questions of our armed services. Gavel to Gavel will also be covering this availability. The purpose of today's meeting is the annual update from our commanders of our military branches proudly stationed in the state of Alaska. We have Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach, the commander of the 11th Air Force in Alaska Command. We have Major General Brian Owens, commanding general of the U.S. Army Alaska. Rear Admiral Michael McAllister, the commander of the 17th U.S. Coast Guard District, and Major General Lori Hummel, the Adjutant General of the State of the Alaska National Guard and the Commissioner of the Department of Public and Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. So next is the statutory legislative liaison to the active component of the military, Major General Hummel. Will give us a brief introduction of each of the commanders, and committee members and the public will have a more extensive biography before them. So, Major General,
good welcome. Afternoon, co-chairs, Senator Costello, Representative Kawasaki, members of the Joint Armed Services Committee, and my esteemed colleagues, and ladies and gentlemen, and Alaskans everywhere. Thank you for the opportunity to brief you today on the activities, plans, future hopes and concerns of the four military commands serving you here in Alaska. Alaska statute directs the Adjutant General as the official liaison between the state and active military within the state. And this is welcome duty because it gives me the opportunity to work closely with the leaders and the service members of all branches of the military in Alaska and to represent the state in military matters. There are many areas where the active component military and the four divisions of your organized militia for the state, the Army Guard, the Air Guard, the Naval Militia, and the State Defense Force work together. Teamwork and a sense of common purpose are the touchstones for the military in Alaska, and I am proud to introduce my mission partners and teammates in the order in which they'll be briefing you today. Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach, seated to my right, wears three hats. He is commander of the Alaska region of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, commonly known as NORAD. He is commander of Alaskan Command, which is subordinate to the U.S. Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, and he is also commander of 11th Air Force, all at the same time. General Wilsbach's headquarters is at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. Major General Brian Owens is the commanding general of USARAC, United States Army Alaska. He's also my neighbor at J-Bear. and Rear Admiral Michael McAllister, commander of the 17th U.S. Coast Guard District, is stationed just down the street here in Juneau. We four represent different branches and components of military service, each with a broad range of experience and expertise, serving a wide variety of missions, but you'll soon see many examples of how our paths frequently intersect and our missions mesh. We are especially proud of the way the skilled and dedicated men and women that we are privileged to lead work together every day for the common good of Alaska and for our nation. It's invigorating, it's challenging, it's humbling, and it's supremely rewarding work. Members of the committee, our time today is very limited, so I'd like to move directly to the briefings. And with that, I'd like to introduce Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity. And I'd like to, first of all, thank General Hummel. And but she said it, but I'd like to, you know, foot stomp the partnership that we all have together between General Owens, General Hummel, and Admiral McAllister. We could not do our mission if we didn't have that collaboration. And not only are we co-workers and fellow commanders, but we're also friends, and we talk with one another a lot. And our folks work every day together, and so it's a great relationship. I'd also like to take the opportunity to thank the Alaska state government, as well as the National Alaska delegation and the governor, for the tremendous support that we in the military get from the state of Alaska. You may have heard me say before, but I'll say it again for this committee. When military members come here, they get an experience that's unlike any place else that they might be stationed. What they get is, and you get this in other places, hey, we really appreciate the mission that you all are doing. We support military members and so forth. And you get that in other places. But what you don't get in other places is what you get here in Alaska, which is you're coming to my house for Thanksgiving. Come over to my house for Christmas. You're coming to my party, you know, Saturday night. You become a family member. And it's why so many military members end up staying here, because they're so welcomed here. And so it really means a lot to the military members that come here to serve our country, to be very much welcomed by the people of Alaska. And so I would just like to say thank you to the people of Alaska for how they support the military. We could go to the next chart, please. Here are the things that I'll cover quickly, and I'll save some time at the end for some questions. But we'll just look at what we've been doing over the last year, how we're doing now, take a look into the future, and really give you a sense for what we're really paying close attention to. That's what's on our scope. So you'll have to forgive me for some of my airman mentality. Next chart, please. So the first thing I'd like to tell you about is some of the exercises that we do here in Alaska. And some of these are under my 11th Air Force hat. Some of them are under my Alaska NORAD region hat, and some are under my Alaskan Command hat. But two that I'd like to really point out that you should know about. And the first one on the left-hand side there is Arctic Chinook. And so we'll talk a little bit more about the Arctic and how it's really opening up to human activity. But that's where the genesis of this exercise started was when the Crystal Serenity, which was the cruise ship that went through the Bering Straits across the North Slope, across the northern coast of Canada and back into New York, we realized that what if that ship had some trouble during its voyage, what would we do? And so the Arctic Chinook exercise brought together not only the Air Force, but, of course, the Coast Guard was there, the Army was there, the National Guard was all there, exercising to respond to a very similar type of event whereby the cruise ship has trouble. Now we need to get maybe as many as 1,500 passengers to safety and then evacuated and cared for along the way. No easy task, and those that are from Alaska know how big the state is, know how remote some of the places where that ship was cruising is, and how difficult that might be for the state agencies as well as partnered up with the military, both state and federal. So it was a great exercise, very successful, and it really opened our eyes to some of the lessons learned that we did learn, and now we're ready to execute if we get called to do that. The other one that I'd really like to point out on this slide, just in the interest of time, and I can take questions on the other ones if you'd like, is Red Flag Alaska. Now, you probably have heard of Red Flag Alaska. We usually do three or four of these exercises a year. We base the aircraft out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson as well as Eielson. We often have nations that come from all over the world. Last year we had 16 nations that participated, and we'll have some international opportunities this year. But we take advantage of the joint Alaska Range Complex, which is some of the greatest ranges in the world, certainly is the biggest. It is very high-tech, and it really allows us to practice and exercise the high end of aerial combat. And when the other nations come here and they get the opportunity, it's often the very best training that they've ever had in their life, and they want to come back. And so it also allows them to be able to integrate with U.S. forces. And so when and if we ever get called to go somewhere where we'll integrate with that particular nation, they've done it before in training. And so it's a tremendous opportunity. And I'd just like to thank Alaska for providing us that range space because, like I said, best in the world, especially for fifth generation, because of its size, we can really bring out the fifth generation aircraft that have capabilities that require space to exercise. Next slide. So a few operations and events. So unlike exercises, these are real-world things. And two that I want to highlight, they're in yellow at the bottom right. The first one is we have a rescue coordination center that works 24/7. It's in combination with the U.S. Air Force as well as the National Guard of Alaska. But oftentimes, U.S. Army aircraft are involved with the rescue. This past year, we had 53 Alaskans that were saved by this rescue force. Typically, they will fly multiple missions, but typically it averages about one save per week your Alaska forces are executing in partnership with one another. Another 24/7 mission that we have that's executed out of Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson as well as Eielson is our defense of North America. We're partnering up with Canada. And we obviously have fighters on alert. They're able to launch in a few minutes. And we also have an AWACS aircraft for being able to surveil any airspace that we might want to surveil in response to any threats that we perceive, as well as a tanker that sits alert up at Eielson, which is able to refuel those assets once they get airborne. And so in addition to that, the National Guard squadron that operates 24/7 is monitoring the numerous radar feeds that come in from all over the state that monitor the airspace around Alaska. One other operation that I would like to highlight is at the top left of this slide, which is Operation Colony Glacier. And you may be familiar with this, but in 1952, a C-124 cargo aircraft crashed on Colony Glacier, killing everybody aboard. It was missing for many decades. And a National Guard helicopter spotted wreckage a few years ago, and we went in to look at it, and we discovered that, in fact, it was this aircraft. And so over the last few summers, we've been doing recovery of the remains. And so thus far, we've gotten a few remains through the years, and so we'll go about starting that exercise or this operation again this summer. It's a combination of National Guard as well as U.S. Air Force, and so another partnership. Next slide, please. So I know Alaskans are very familiar with this chart, and I often use this chart for people that aren't familiar with where Alaska is and the strategic implications thereof. But if you take a look at the quote at the bottom of the slide, it came from Brigadier General Billy Mitchell in 1935 when he was testifying before Congress. And he said, Alaska is the most strategic place on Earth. And in 1935, he probably had no idea what we could do today compared to what they could do back then. But if you look at the map and you see Alaska's in the center of the globe there, and you see that yellow shaded oval, that yellow oval represents about 9 hours flying time from Alaska. And so if you look to see where you can reach into South America, you can just about get to almost every capital in the Northern Hemisphere and almost all the major cities in the Northern Hemisphere. And that presents a great force projection capability. And it's why Alaska has military forces here, because we are able to deploy to either do humanitarian assistance around the world or if there is some sort of conflict, our national leadership can deploy us from here in pretty rapid fashion. And you will be proud to know that we do have forces that are downrange right now in Southwest Asia. They execute daily missions against ISIS, and you'll be very proud to know that right now the 525 Fighter Squadron F-22s have been dropping numerous weapons and destroying targets in both Iraq and Syria over the last several months. And they got their training right here in Alaska. So thank you for that opportunity. Next slide, please. So I know that many of you are very, very familiar with some of these, but I point this out because a lot of people that I talk to that aren't as familiar with Alaska aren't aware of this. But the Arctic is evolving, and if you take a peek at the bottom right of this chart, it shows where the ice used to be in the red, the Arctic ice in the red outline, and where it is pretty much in the summertime, and so it's receding. What that's done is it's opened up a transit lane, and it's opened up opportunities for human activity in the Arctic. If you look at the top right of the slide, you can see some transit routes. It saves a considerable amount of time if you're sailing through the Arctic to cut across the globe because the distances are shorter. Same reason why we fly Great Circle routes. Mariners fly Great Circle routes in the Arctic, and when it's open, it saves them considerable amount of time and cost in the transit. There's also quite a number of other reasons to be in the Arctic. We saw from the Crystal Serenity we have tourism, and of course we all know how resource-rich the Arctic is with natural resources as well as marine life. And so many countries, if you go to the top left, have claims in the Arctic. And I think one good news is that thus far those claims, while overlapping, we've resolved those. We, the Arctic communities, have resolved those peacefully. But if you look in the bottom left, you can see Russia's claim in the red there on the top of the globe picture. Concerning because it overlaps with many other nations. And so we want the Arctic to remain a peaceful place. But one thing that concerns me as a military person is I look at Russia and what they're building as far as Arctic-capable combat forces, significantly offensive capability. They have as many as 40 icebreakers, which makes sense given that much of their country borders the Arctic, and they have to keep those sea lanes open. But the offensive capability certainly concerns me. And responsibilities through my NORTHCOM commander is to make sure that we have a good Arctic strategy, and we do. And what I'll tell you is that we're very much committed to maintaining peace in the Arctic. Next slide, please. Well, a little bit maybe focused in on one topic, which I know everybody is very interested in, and that's the F-35 being installed into Eielson Air Force Base. We plan on getting 54 total aircraft. The first aircraft will begin to arrive in the spring or summer of 2020, and the last aircraft should be delivered on or before the winter of 2022. In the meantime, we have quite a bit of building to do. It's about $500 million worth of military construction over the next couple of years. It's already begun, and it's a number of buildings that will be constructed to bring on this new mission. And I say new mission because we're not trading the F-35 for something else. We're actually installing it as a new mission. And so that brings about 3,500 additional personnel to the base and effectively doubles the base population. One of the things that I'd like to highlight is housing. And so we're going to max out the base housing there at Eielson. And so I've been talking to the mayors around Eielson Air Force Base and North Pole and Fairbanks and asking them to really consider some construction for housing. So young families that will be coming to the Fairbanks area, North Pole area, they'll need a place to live. And so certainly housing is one thing that we could all use your help with. A little bit more on MILCOM, if we could go to the next slide. Not all of these are Air Force programs. In fact, they're color-coded. Red would be mostly Army and National Guard. Certainly green is Army, and then blue is Air Force. But you can see that Alaska is doing very well from the standpoint of economic impact through DOD. So you can see there, just in FY17, $563 million invested here in Alaska, which is number one of all 50 states, and it's actually $120 million more than the next closest state. And so our national leadership also recognizes the strategic nature of Alaska, and we have to invest here to be able to be ready to execute our mission. And so my last slide here, just before I take any of your questions, are those things that are very important to me as the commander of the three organizations that I lead. The first and our number one priority is Homeland Defense. And I told you the forces that we have to execute that on a daily basis. And then if there was a significant threat, we certainly could increase the amount of forces that we have dedicated to that. We keep a very close eye toward the threat. We certainly feel like the threat that has been talked about in the national media is all of them have some sort of implication to us here in Alaska. I've already talked about Russia. China is another one. North Korea, we've all been watching the news with respect to North Korea and their nuclear aspirations, as well as developing an intercontinental ballistic missile that has us all concerned. Of course, Iran, and we might think that Iran might not have much of an implication here to Alaska, but if Iran were ever to employ intercontinental ballistic missiles against the United States, they would go by here. And so our forces that are at Fort Greely would certainly be responsible for intercepting those inbound missiles. And so that's why we pay attention to Iran. And then international terrorism or violent extremist organizations, we certainly are fighting that now, as we have forces downrange fighting them even today. And I'd remind you to think about those families that are left here behind in Alaska while their loved ones are fighting. Keep them in your thoughts and prayers if you're so inclined. And so all of the threats that have been named as the top priorities for DOD have some sort of implications to us here in Alaska. Certainly, because of that, we are ready to fight tonight. And so one of my bosses, my Air Force boss, that's one of his primary objectives, is that our forces are ready to deploy and fight at any time, and I can report to you that they are. Arctic advocacy, I've told you that we are paying attention to the Arctic, and I am frequently, especially from the Air Force standpoint, the Arctic expert, being that we spend a lot of time operating here, and my colleagues that you'll hear from here in a bit are the same in their respective services, and so we tend to be the voice of the Arctic, especially from the U.S. standpoint in the military. Northern Edge, you've probably heard about Northern Edge. It's an exercise that's much like Red Flag Alaska, although we add in a maritime component. It's going to be happening this May, from May 1st to May 12th, and I know there's been some concern about the maritime portion. Specifically, Alaska Native fishermen as well as the commercial fishermen have expressed a concern, along with some environmental groups. We've listened to those concerns, and we've modified the exercise to try to stay as far away from their activities as we could, knowing that it's their livelihood. But the exercise provides a great opportunity to bring together air and maritime forces to fight jointly in an exercise environment, which is how we actually fight in the real world. And so it's a great opportunity for us to do that here. And, again, I'd like to thank Alaskans for providing the airspace as well as the maritime space to be able to do that. And then lastly, taking care of families. I talked about those that are deployed, but as you know, many military members come up to Alaska and they don't know much about Alaska when they get there and they fall in love with it, but they're still a long way from home generally, or a lot of times, and so we want to take care of them not only when their loved ones are deployed, but also while they're here. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about quality of life and their life outside of the military, so that we can retain them and they have a good quality of life as they serve their country. Well, with that, let me stop and see if you have any questions for me. And if you don't, I'll turn it over to Major General Brian Owens.
I want to thank you for your efficiency. You've caught us up just about to the time we should be. There are a couple of questions, first from Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here. Very much appreciate it. On slide 8, you gave a very brief just highlight on the Clear Air Force station. That's my dad was the site manager of the anti-ballistic early warning system, so it's
a great job.
Near and dear to my heart back in 1960. So anyway, if you don't mind just giving a really brief update, I went to Fairbanks this summer and got a wonderful, amazing insights on what was going on up there. But if you could just briefly give us a quick update on that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, so I would like, I'll give you a very quick one because I really am not the expert on the radar writ large, and many of the forces that are up there actually belong to General Hummel. And so maybe if I could do a kind of a halfway handoff to her, and when it's her turn, maybe she could address that. But I was just up at Clear Knot too long ago, just a few weeks ago. A tremendous amount of construction, as you can see, a lot of construction, a lot of upgrades to the radar. That radar is integral to the defense of North America from the standpoint of ballistic missiles. It also has a great capability for keeping track of space activity, spacecraft. So, and it also sees space junk. It's a tremendous radar with a tremendous capability that allows the United States one, be safe, i.e., the radar helps out with the Fort Greely missiles, the ground-based interceptors. There's a connection between those two sites, and so if anyone were to ever shoot a ballistic missile in our direction, that radar would pick it up and then feed the coordinates to the missiles at Fort Greely, and then they can conduct the intercept. So making sure that the long-range radar is up to speed and can react to the tactics, techniques, and procedures of any threat that might be coming our way from the standpoint of decoys and maneuvering reentry vehicles and all those sorts of things. It's important that we keep that up to speed. In addition, some of the facilities there are fairly old, and so they're being renovated or they're building new. And so it's a fairly remote site, as you know very well. And so making sure that the airmen and the soldiers that that live and work there have a place to live is also very important to us. And I'll yield the rest of the question to Lori.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question, at least to start? Okay, thank
great
you.
Great job.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned a few of the countries that you're looking at, China, North Korea, Russia, Iran. Would you say that the threat level has legitimately increased? We read things in the paper, hear things on TV all the time, and it's just hard to gauge whether or not that's the press spinning that up or whether or not that's an actual threat level increase, number one. And number two, would you say that Alaska, because of our proximity, would be a likely target for any of those countries?
For the first one, I would have to say it depends on the country. Certainly North Korea. And the rhetoric that's coming out of North Korea and the activity that we're seeing makes me as a military commander have concern that the threat has increased. And so because of the strategic nature of Alaska, we assume, which is why we defend this land, that there are facilities here that could be considered targets. So that's why we have forces that are capable of defending the nation from here.
Representative Ledoux, and then we'll take one more question.
Nice to see you, General.
To see you, ma'am.
So you mentioned that Russia is claiming part of the Arctic. Under what color of international law is it making those claims? And does anybody else claim the Arctic? Do we claim the Arctic?
We have some claims, and you can see up here all the different colors represent various claims, and you can see some of them are overlapping. And so this is all this is all international law, maritime law. A lot of it's maritime law, and so because the various countries have made predominantly historical claims, so, hey, we used to operate there thousands of years ago, so therefore we claim it. And many countries have overlapping claims, as I've said. And so the good news, and I said this before, but I'll emphasize it again, thus far all of these countries have managed their various claims, some of them overlapping, very peacefully and in a very diplomatic way. So there hasn't been a conflict. There's been no even threat of conflict in the Arctic to this point, and that's the way we want to keep it. I mean, that's in everyone's best interest. Everyone here in the Arctic's best interest to keep the disagreements to a collegial and diplomatic nature. And I think if we'll strive to do that, we can work out the differences over the course of the years on who gets the specific economic rights to those particular. It's either mostly water or it's ice, depending on what time of the year it is.
Can I just follow up?
Representative Ledoux.
So are all of those competing nations and claims, do they have people on the ground there?
I think at times of the year, many of those countries are operating there. Most of them are vessels. But occasionally, we have people on the ice. We do. We the U.S. does. And other countries do as well. Some of them are military maneuvers that we do. For example, ICEX, which we did a couple of years ago, where we punched a submarine through the ice, and then we set up a camp on top of the ice. And so other countries are doing very similar things. But, again, those are just military exercises, basically in international waters, which are perfectly legal and understandable, and we're not claiming any up that far north. We're not claiming any territory there. So far, everybody's, as far as I can tell, everybody is operating in accordance with international law, and these claims, are in the international dialogue, and if they continue to be diplomatic in nature, I think we're going to be good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we now, because of us, we've lost all of our extra time that the general gave us, but we have two questions. If we could just quickly put them on the record, and if you have a quick answer, maybe you could try to respond to it. We have Colonel Jones and then Senator Coghill.
I'll answer quickly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, first, thanks. And thanks for what you and your soldiers and your airmen do for us defending our nation on a daily basis. General, our House and Senate are currently considering legislation to enact a Real ID compliant identification. Without a waiver, which I understand is not likely, without passage of this legislation, the hundreds of Alaskans who work as contractors on our military installations are going to be denied entry in June, as I understand it. You briefed over $500 million in MILCON for just FY17 and $512 million for the F-35s, there's over $400 million for the LRDR. There's a lot of money in Interior Alaska. And as you know, for Interior Alaska's economy, the military is a big portion of that. I think it's important that this committee support this legislation. In general, I would ask, do you think an additional waiver is possible should this legislation fail to pass, and do you have any thoughts on the impact?
So I know what I've been briefed as far as the law goes, and starting in June, I've got to comply with the law, which is if you don't have a Real ID compliant ID, you have to be escorted on the base. And so doesn't mean you can't get on the base, it just you have to be escorted. And so there's three ways. So you can have an ID, some sort of ID that's compliant, and that could be a passport, it could be a military ID, it could be a driver's license from another state that is compliant, or it could be an Alaska one that is eventually compliant, and then you could be escorted on the base. So there's a number of ways you can still, or there's one way you can still get on the base, even if you don't have any of those, which is to be escorted, which it causes a little bit of an extra burden on the base, but possible. But I don't want to comment on any waivers because I don't have any real authority to grant the waiver, but I do have authority to comply with the law, which we'll have to do starting in June.
Thank you.
Sure. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your service and all those in uniform for your service in this room today. I read and understand about 3 years ago that Russia was planning a $10 billion buildup of unmanned aircraft on their side of the Arctic, And I'm wondering if you're aware of whether that's proceeding forward or if it didn't happen, and if it is, whether we are balanced on our side with what we currently have, or are there efforts to try to match that, whether through unmanned aircraft or other means?
So I don't know about the figure, so I don't quote me on the figure, but I can tell you that they are advancing in their unmanned aerial vehicles, and we believe that they're going to put them in the far east of their country, which would border up against us. And so to answer your question in short, and I can go into detail offline if you'd like, but we're postured for that.
Great. Thank you. Lieutenant General Wilsbach, we appreciate your time and efforts these days. We appreciate all of your service as well.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. And next we will have Major General Brian Owens, who will brief us on the latest of the U.S. Army. And I think I'll take a brief at ease to change over presentations.
Good afternoon, Senator Costello, Representative Kawasaki, the members of the Joint Armed Services Committee, and of course, members of our great Alaskan public. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak this morning, or this afternoon. It's been an honor to be invited up here to give you some idea of the activities of your Army, active Army, in Alaska. And it's a privilege to serve in this magnificent state. My family and I feel fortunate that we get to enjoy this opportunity. And there's no question that our soldiers and families are blessed with the unwavering support from our state and local officials, the area businesses, and the citizens around the surrounding communities. I'd like to also personally express my gratitude and appreciation for everything you do to make the last frontier such a great place to live. By the way, this, I'll get into it in a subsequent portion of the brief, but this is a picture taken up at Dead Horse, minus 63 degrees. Those soldiers, paratroopers, spent 4 hours up in that cold region, and this is just one of the snapshots from that. Next slide. So as many of you know, we have active duty Army unit stationed primarily in Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Fort Wainwright is the home of the nation's most northernmost Stryker Brigade Combat Team and the USARAC Aviation Task Force. First Stryker just executed a very successful NTC rotation at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, this past January. And this rigorous training exercise tested and validated the Arctic Wolves' capabilities across all the warfighting functions and ensure the brigades prepared to deploy, fight, and win in a complex environment. Our General Support Aviation Battalion just recently deployed to Afghanistan. The Flying Dragon sent approximately 300 soldiers and aircraft to conduct heliborne operations to assist and train the Afghan security forces. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is the home of our headquarters, USARAC headquarters, which has primary responsibility to provide training and readiness authority over the assigned units, as well as provide oversight for the active duty armed forces in the state of Alaska. Maneuver forces located at JBEAR include our 425 Infantry Brigade Combat Team, the only U.S. Army airborne brigade in the Asia-Pacific Theater of Operations. JBEAR is also the home of our 17th Combat Sustainment Support Battalion with diverse missions and capabilities. Both the units are keeping very busy with exercises to ensure readiness and deployments in support of worldwide operations. Approximately 160 soldiers from JBEAR and Fort Wainwright just deployed to fight ISIS with the 574th Combat Support Company, which was activated October of 14 under 17th CSSB. And this will be the unit's first deployment since activation, but it's the sixth deployment for the commander. 425 will be headed to the Joint Readiness Training Center this summer in June to do a decisive action training environment rotation, and they're on track to train there at Fort Polk, Louisiana. Our third location in Alaska is the Northern Warfare Training Center located at Black Rapids near Fort Greely. This is the Army's Center for World-Class Arctic and Mountain Warfare Instruction. Uniquely postured in the interior of Alaska, our training lands allow us to leverage the nearly 1.6 million acres of Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex. And just to put that in perspective, our National Training Center is 2.5 times smaller than the training area that we have here in Alaska. Our troopers are trained to thrive, not just survive in extreme cold, and our history is replete with examples of armies that were decimated because they weren't prepared to survive and fight in the cold. Next slide. Our nation depends on its Army to help with recovery efforts in the wake of a natural disaster, to defeat enemy forces abroad, and to defend the shores of the homeland. Your professional soldiers work, study, and train to ensure the Army will not fail in its call to meet the needs of our nation. United States Army Alaska is at the forefront of protecting America's interests in Asia-Pacific region, while also providing ready and relevant forces to overseas contingency operations and homeland defense. Alaska is one of the U.S. military's most centrally located power projection platform. We benefit from joint training opportunities in diverse environments, providing ideal training grounds to prepare our soldiers for the challenges of our times. Alaska is the only one of the 50 U.S. states that borders the Arctic. USARAC's location in the Arctic environment confers unique challenges, but it also gives us tremendous opportunities. Conditions in Alaska require Arctic fieldcraft, the knowledge and ability to conduct sustainment operations and sustained operations in an environment where the temperatures hover below minus 50. Storms generated at hurricane force winds, and the terrain is impassable with lower 48 land mobility systems. To overcome these challenges, we build Arctic toughness through joint and multinational exercises. Home station training is critical to our unit readiness, and Alaska is one of the best places in the nation where our soldiers can train and prepare for the challenges that lie ahead. Developing bilateral and multilateral relationships with our international partners that have shared goals and mutual interests is also very vital to us. We train with foreign partners who have cold weather experience. We also invite them here for the Cold Region Military Mountaineering Collaborative Training Event. The next one will be in February of next year, 2018, and will include cold weather experts from around the world. Our forces also support the Pacific Commander's Theater Engagement Strategy, which routinely involves our soldiers in exercises and engagements with our partners in Japan, Canada, Thailand, Nepal, India, and Mongolia. This summer, our striker and airborne brigades will play a central role in Pacific pathways conducted around the Pacific in Australia, Singapore, Thailand, and Japan. I'd like to highlight just two recent exercises that exemplify the great capabilities of our units and demonstrate the terrific training that we can accomplish here in Alaska. The first one was conducted, it's Arctic Anvil, and it was conducted in the Joint Pacific Alaska Training Complex last summer. It focused on providing a robust home station training force-on-force combat exercise, primarily to test and prove the readiness of 1st Striker Brigade and the aviation units that we had deploying down in advance of their national training center deployment. Fort Wainwright's newest aviation units, our Apache Battalion and the Gray Eagle Company, had the opportunity to train in a joint multinational combined arms exercise. It was the largest we've had in Alaska since 2001. Over 5,000 soldiers participated in this joint multinational, multi-component exercise, including people from U.S. Army Alaska, our Alaska National Guard, and I'd like to publicly say thanks to General Hummel and her team. We could not do it without them. It's integral to our success. The Iowa National Guard, U.S. Air Force And again, a shout out to General Wilsbach and his third wing, that I have never seen the relationship in my 34 years in the Army. It's unsurpassed elsewhere. This is a really great relationship that we have between our Air Forces and our Army forces here. And then we had 196th Infantry Brigade, some Canadian military, and observers from Singapore and Japan. Arta Campbell was selected by our higher headquarters to test the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Capability, and it's a deployable training system with instrumentation and observer controller trainers that enhance the ability to conduct our home station training. So our Army is going to more and more of the home station training. Arta Campbell improved the readiness of the Alaska-based units while exercising deployment and redeployment nodes, and was very successful showing the training capabilities. Next slide. I just briefly mentioned Spartan Pegasus. It was very cold that day. As I mentioned, wind chill was minus 57 at drop time and then minus 63 by the end of the mission. Very proud of our paratroopers. They jumped into Dead Horse and applied the Arctic mobility training to recover and secure a simulated downed aircraft or downed satellite. This was the third large airborne operation that we've done up in near the Arctic Ocean coast. We had generals there from Japan and Canada, as well as senior leaders from the U.S. Army, National Guard, and Air Force. Again, it made me very proud to see our soldiers operating in that environment. The way ahead, our airborne forces are very busy getting ready for their multinational joint readiness training center event. I already mentioned the strikers that are participating in Pacific Pathways this summer. I also want to mention I'll be leaving command in July, and I've been so fortunate to have the honor of commanding U.S. Army Alaska. My successor was announced on Monday. It's Major General Mark O'Neill. He's currently the USRPAC Chief of Staff, and I'm confident that he'll the great accomplishments will continue after I leave. A team of USRAC German and Canadian soldiers will attempt to ascend Denali again this spring. Bad weather last year kept us from summiting. Our airborne brigade has been invited to participate in Japan's first jump next year. That's an annual event, and so it's a great honor for us to be able to participate there. Next slide. So in the interest of time, I'm going to stop here. I just want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address you this afternoon, and I want to thank you for your service to the state. You all make Alaska feel like home for all of us, and we just really do appreciate you. We appreciate what our Alaskan communities, the support we get from the Alaskan communities. Arctic warriors, Arctic tough, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Great, thank you. We have a brief moment for a couple questions. First question is, are you retiring or are you being reassigned?
I'm actually transitioning, and my family and I are going to stay in Anchorage. So it's not just words. We love Alaska, and so we're gonna stay, and I'm gonna transition to the next chapter, whatever that might be.
Wonderful, wonderful. We have a question from Senator Costello.
Thank you, General Owens. Thank you so much for your service and for all the men and women in uniform and their families for what you provide to our state. I want to extend a sincere thank you for that. As you know, our state is experiencing a recession, and we're trying to do everything we can to keep our economy healthy, and I think the presence of the military in our state is foundational to that and to the success that we're going to be seeing with our economy. My question has to do with something that I read in the Association of the United States Army that gave me cause for concern, and so my question is, what can we here in Alaska be doing and what are you doing to prevent the BRAC process from occurring?
So I saw the same discussions on BRAC. BRAC is not necessarily bad in some cases for us to be able to consolidate some pieces. Right now, as far as our Army forces here, there's no force structure changes, and so for the next couple of years, and so as we sort out the budget pieces nationally, as you saw, there's some end strength increases for the Army, about 16,000, 26,000 overall, but about 16,000 to the active force. Now, we probably will not see those changes up in Alaska, but we will see no force cuts in the near future. So to your point, and just the short answer is I'm not hearing anything that shows any kind of reorganization or structure changes here in Alaska for the Army.
Thank you.
Thanks. Are there further questions for Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if you could get an update, give us a brief update on the EIS process that's taking place at J-Bear, and you know, as I understand it, they're, because of the work on the two runways and the noise concerns, that there's, you know, a new process that's been initiated, and I guess I just kind of lost track of where that is, but several of us are right in the backyard of that work.
Yeah, so and that would be the previous.
Okay, I was not sure who I should direct that to. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
This is just a voice of gratitude. Your work with the University of Alaska on the Gray Eagle and some of the communication issues, I think you're helping us work through FAA issues as well. So it's just duly noted and appreciated.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Major General Owens. We appreciate your time, and we wish you a safe and speedy transition into Anchorage life. let's see. We're going to have next Rear Admiral Michael McAllister will provide us a briefing on the Coast Guard 17th District. Admiral McAllister.
So, Representative Kawasaki, Senator Costello, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a privilege to be here today with the State of Alaska Joint Armed Services Committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak about the great work that the Coast Guard men and women are doing here in the last frontier. The Coast Guard serves and safeguards the public, protects the maritime environment and its resources, and defends the nation's interests in the Alaska maritime region. In a state as vast as Alaska, we can't do that alone, so we work very closely with federal, state, local, Alaska Native partners, as well as through transparent engagement with industries and non-governmental and private organizations to meet the diverse needs of the maritime public here. The 17th Coast Guard District includes the entire state of Alaska and its 44,000 miles of coastline. Coast Guard units and personnel conduct search and rescue missions in an area of responsibility that covers 3.8 million square miles of ocean, an area larger than the landmass of the entire United States, including Alaska. And we're continually reminded of the hazards of the marine environment through such events as the recent tragic sinking of the fishing vessel Destination and the loss of her six crew in February, and the successful rescue of 46 crew members from the fishing vessel Alaska Juris when it sank 690 miles west of Dutch Harbor last July. Coast Guard men and women are at sea and in the air every day to provide emergency response. Coast Guard missions also include homeland security and military defense, maintenance of aids to navigation, environmental preparedness and response, and marine safety of both recreational and commercial vessels throughout the state of Alaska. As the nation's smallest armed force, the Coast Guard performs these statutory missions throughout Alaska with 2,500 highly professional active duty, reserve, civilian, and auxiliary or volunteer members that I'm honored to represent here today. Today, I plan to focus my remarks on our broad security missions, which cover not only defense, but also environmental and economic security. In the Alaska regions, one of our primary missions is to protect living marine resources and ensure both the safety and sustainability of the $6 billion fishing industry in Alaska. To do this, we work very closely with federal and state partners to conduct fishing vessel boardings dockside, inshore, and throughout our exclusive economic zone, or 200 or more miles offshore. We have a sustainable fisheries program in Alaska because all of the participants fulfill their important roles in the active management of our resources. On the international front, we also work closely with other Northern Pacific countries such as Russia, China, Japan, Canada, and South Korea. We conduct joint patrols and law enforcement activities, some of which are shown in your handout and on the screen. And these are activities to enforce treaties designed to protect highly migratory fisheries, such as salmon, from illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing activity on the high seas. Despite heightened global tensions, cooperation amongst these nations remains strong, and our joint efforts have reduced overfishing in the region. Protecting Alaska's valuable marine resources and pristine environment also relies on a robust system to prevent and, when necessary, respond to oil and chemical spills. And I'm reminded that tomorrow is the 28th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez grounding in Prince William Sound. The Exxon Valdez spilled 10.1 million gallons of crude oil, and I can tell you that we have advanced significantly since that time. And in fact, Exxon Valdez created new authorities for the Coast Guard to be more proactive both in prevention and response to spills. As the nation's lead for commercial vessel safety and the federal lead for spill response in the coastal zones of Alaska, we work together with state and local counterparts to manage this system through activities such as oil spill response planning, training and exercises, certification of oil spill response organizations, and on-scene oversight of spill cleanup efforts. We must focus on continuing to improve our capabilities over time, and the Coast Guard has published draft guidelines for the implementation of vessel response plans with alternative criteria that allows us to tailor our approaches to the unique challenges of working in remote areas of Alaska. We also coordinate, as shown on the slide, with our Canadian Coast Guard to conduct annual exercises near our two maritime borders with our neighbors. And after a number of years with limited progress, we have restarted talks with our Russian counterparts to update and exercise our existing U.S.-Russian joint contingency plan for oil spills along our maritime border. The Commandant of the Coast Guard is focused on maintaining our commitment to excellence and building our capabilities in the service to our nation. We're highly excited to receive two new fast response cutters in Alaska this spring. These are highly capable small ships that will allow us to expand our operations, particularly in Southeast and South Central and the Gulf of Alaska. We will also receive C-130J models starting in 2018, providing extended range and endurance for search and rescue and other missions in Alaska, and we recently upgraded our marine communications equipment in Southeast and South Central. And of particular note, the Coast Guard recently awarded a contract to design and build offshore patrol cutters. These ships are tailor-made to operate effectively at long distances and in rough seas like those common in Alaskan waters. And we expect to see those ships coming off the production line in the early 2020s. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Coast Guard service in Alaska, which began when one of our predecessor agencies, the Revenue Cutter Service, transported government officials to Sitka for the land transfer from Russia in 1867. During that same trip, the revenue cutter Lincoln went on to conduct its first Alaska patrol, completing coastal surveys, protecting Alaska's natural resources, and serving as an important and often sole U.S. federal presence in this vast territory. And we've been here ever since. I can attest that the Coast Guard men and women are proud to serve here and are welcomed in all of Alaska's communities, and we're likewise proud to serve alongside our fellow military members of the Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marine Corps of the Active Reserve and National Guard components. This committee's support to providing a welcoming environment for our service members and their families is very much appreciated. And while we have these 150 years of experience to build off of, We continue to learn from each of our events about the challenges of operating in this vitally important state and adapt our operations to meet future challenges we will face. Nowhere is that more evident than in the Arctic region. As the extent of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean has continued to recede, as General Wolsblock had noted, we've seen a steady increase in the number and types of vessels transiting through those waters in summer months. As a result, we've been conducting extensive summertime operations in the Arctic region for several years now. We call this annual operation Arctic Shield. In 2016, we had numerous Coast Guard ships deployed across the Arctic region, conducting patrols, visiting coastal communities, maintaining ice navigation, supporting research and development, and conducting exercises. Shoreside teams conducted training with village fire departments and volunteers on oil spill response, cold water survival, and ice rescues. And in a continuing partnership with the State of Alaska Boating Safety Division, we visited 23 Alaskan communities to provide education through the Kids Don't Float program to over 2,900 children in Alaska. Among some of the highlights from last year, we deployed two MH-60 helicopters, air crews, and maintenance personnel in Kotzebue. We're very much appreciative of the support that we received from the National Guard, from General Hummel and her staff, for use of their hangar facility there, which was instrumental in those operations. We prepared for the historic transit of the cruise ship Crystal Serenity and her 1,600 passengers and crew by working closely with the cruise line, the Canadian Coast Guard, and local villages to ensure the voyage was safe and productive. And as General Wolsblock noted, there were numerous Coast Guard units working alongside their Department of Defense and National Guard counterparts, particularly from ALCOM and Alaska National Guard, plus other state agencies such as the Health and Human Services, to conduct Exercise Arctic Chinook. You can see some photographs here of that event, which simulated the forced evacuation of a cruise ship far from major population centers. Now, this was done. This was actually the first exercise under the new Arctic Council Search and Rescue Agreement, and so we had numerous international observers and Canadian play in the exercise as well. And as mentioned before, it provided us an excellent opportunity to collaborate across international, federal, state, and local agencies and to test our deployability and interoperability. As we look ahead to Arctic Shield 2017, this coming summer, we'll build on those events from 2016 and further improve our response capabilities in the Arctic region. We do anticipate deploying two MH-60 helicopters in Kotzebue again, multiple Coast Guard cutters offshore, ice rescue training in various locations, and oil spill response exercises and training in Dillingham and Barrow. We do expect Crystal Serenity to make another Northwest Pass trip this year, and my understanding is that there are additional cruise lines that are considering similar voyages in succeeding years. Also on the Arctic front, after working closely with Alaska Native communities, environmental organizations, and federal and state partners, as well as industry, we recently published our port access route study. This study proposes a 700-mile safe shipping route through the Bering Strait that seeks to avoid environmentally sensitive and subsistence critical areas. In 2017, we will look to expand on that work with the start of a port access route study for the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, and we will coordinate with our Canadian partners as they begin a similar project in the Northwest Passage. The importance of strong partnerships amongst the DOD, federal, state, borough, and Native communities can't be overstated. We fully appreciate the support of the state of Alaska as provided by being an integral part of the events that we participate in. Finally, we look forward to continuous and ongoing opportunities to work with our partners to preserve Alaska's natural resources from threats to the environment, sovereignty, and security, and raise the awareness of the strategic importance of Alaska's role as the nation's sole Arctic state as we start our next 150 years of service in this region. Thank you for allowing me to have a few minutes of your time this morning, this afternoon, and a special thank you to the Joint Armed Services Committee for your continued support of military members throughout this great state.
Thank you, Rear Admiral McAllister. Is there a question? Senator Hughes.
Thank you also for your service. I understand the federal administration has proposed a 12% cut to the U.S. Coast Guard's budget. I'm wondering if you think that might hold and how you might prepare for it, what the impact might be. And also, we heard earlier about the number of icebreakers that Russia has. Are there plans to, down the road, I know they're very, very expensive, but just wondering if there are plans in the future that we might see more icebreakers in our waters.
Well, thank you very much for the question. On Thursday of last week, the Department of Homeland Security put out a press release which indicated that Coast Guard funding would be sustained at current levels, which would allow us to continue our day-to-day operations as well as continue our important investments in infrastructure and to recapitalize our fleet. With regard to icebreakers, the President's fiscal year 17 budget includes $150 million to begin the design work for the first icebreaker that the Coast Guard, heavy icebreaker that the Coast Guard has built in more than 40 years. And so we anticipate that that first icebreaker will be completed with the help of the U.S. Navy for their expertise and acquisition by 2023. The Coast Guard is on record as to recommending that the nation have three what we call heavy icebreakers that are capable of breaking ice year-round in both polar regions, three heavy icebreakers and three medium icebreakers in order to meet the needs of the collective federal family in both polar regions.
Great. Thank you. We have a question from Co-Chair Costello.
Thank you, Rear Admiral McAllister. Appreciate your presentation and all that you do for Alaska. My question is about the U.S. Absence as a signatory to the Law of the Sea Treaty, and could you just comment on are you concerned about that, or how does it impact what you are doing?
Well, the all of the military services, Coast Guard included, have recommended that the U.S. Become a signatory to the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. And the question earlier about the claims, the Arctic claims, the UNCLOS, or the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea, is the basis for the those claims that have been submitted thus far. So one of the practical impacts is that the U.S., until we become a signatory, cannot make a claim for the Arctic region. That said, the U.S. Has agreed that we will conform to all of the stipulations or all of the provisions of UNCLOS without signing it, and so there is no immediate change in the way that we have done business. We continue to interact with other nations around the globe on the high seas under the provisions of UNCLOS, even though we are not a signatory.
Thank you. And I did want to mention I asked that question on behalf of Representative Sadler.
I have a question actually online. We have a question from our committee member, Nelson Angapak. Mr. Angapak, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, let me say that insofar as this is concerned, my question is going to be for Major General Hummel at a later time. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Angapak. I think we have one more question from Senator Coghill.
Sure. It's a two-part question, Admiral. The Arctic Council is going to be meeting here. They're changing the gavel from one nation to the other. But then it's an Arctic issue, and almost all of the issues you deal with somehow involve it. Are you, number one, involved in that discussion? And how do we stack up communication-wise? Part of it is your aids to navigation question, and part of it is search and rescue capacity.
Well, thank you for the question. I'll answer the Arctic Council question first. The Coast Guard supports the Arctic Council, and we have actually created an Arctic Coast Guard forum underneath the Arctic Council, in which we can focus on maritime-related issues amongst the Arctic Council nations. And our commandant is the current chair for that forum. We will similarly be handing off the chair to Finland for the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. And so the U.S. Coast Guard is very much involved with both governance bodies. From a local perspective, My job is to operationalize those things that are agreed to amongst the Arctic Council or the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. So as an example, the Arctic Chinook mass rescue operation that we did was done under the Arctic Search and Rescue Agreement. And so it's our opportunity to contribute, you know, on the global stage in terms of Arctic Council work. With regard to communications, I can tell you that we have improved our communications, which serves really all of our missions, from search and rescue to ace navigation to oil spill response. But this is a big state. As you all know, there are challenges working in remote locations and in the types of environment, weather, and other factors that we work in. And so I'll offer to you that while we've made improvements, there are still gaps, and we will continue to try to fill those gaps. And I would additionally offer that as we look towards operating even more in the Arctic in the future, that will be a high priority, is to establish appropriate communications capability before we have before we, the Coast Guard, or industry, or even the communities along the North Slope or West Alaska have a significant maritime presence there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rear Admiral Michael McAllister. Just wanted to thank you. There's more coastline in the state of Alaska than there is in the rest of the continental United States, so we certainly respect that you are keeping us safe. Okay, once again, we have next Major General Lori Hummel will provide to us an update of the department and the Alaska National Guard. Hummel, welcome.
Thank you again. For the record, I'm Lori Hummel, your Adjutant General, and I'm here with our State Command Chaplain, Colonel Rick Cook. It's appropriate for the home team to bat last, and also we are the oldest service. So when I came here today, I knew that the Air Force seceded from the Army in 1947. And I knew that the Army was born in 1775. Now I know that the Coast Guard is 150 years old. But the progenitor of the National Guard, the organized militia, has been around since 1636. So we're 380 years old, but we don't feel a day over 379. So thank you again for the opportunity to discuss what our organized militia in Alaska has done over the past year. And I use the phrase organized militia because that's the statutory term for our four divisions, the Army Guard, the Air Guard, the State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia. So here is the department's mission as derived from Alaska statute. Your organized militia is involved in every aspect of this mission statement, from combat deployments to supporting our State Emergency Operations Center with ready emergency forces, to serving as mentors for the cadets at the Alaska Military Youth Academy, or as it's known on the third floor of this building, the Governor's High School, to volunteering at veteran stand-down events throughout this this state. Next. Some of you have seen this before. And the bottom line is, I believe that leading a successful organization begins with establishing a shared vision supported by core values. This vision statement outlines our four major lines of effort across the entire Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and those are federal mission assurance, viable Arctic strategy, emergency management capacity, and engaging with Alaska communities. Everything we do as an organization directly supports one of these lines of effort. This focus and common understanding makes us more efficient with our people, our equipment, and importantly, our fiscal resources. Next. So using the next couple of slides, I want to take a moment to highlight some of the things that we've done over the last year that have been noticed in the media. Starting at the upper left and going around the clock, we divested the legacy C-130 fleet on Elmendorf as part of a package where we received ownership of the strategic airlift platform, our C-17s. We're partnering internationally for training and exercises with Mongolians, with Canadians, and with the Danes. Competing, the lower right picture, competing in a field of 120 soldier athletes, five of the seven members of our Alaska National Guard biathlon team skied and shot their way onto the national team. We continued our aviation support of the Colony Glacier recovery operations that General Wilsbach described. And in the bottom left corner, we have been very active in communities recognizing soldiers and airmen who have been overlooked in the past for their service. Next, please. So just to mix it up, I'd like you to start at the top right photo, and we're going to work counterclockwise now. So the top right photos are some of our 47 Army Guard Military Police and Air Guard Security Police who were sworn in as special police by the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department to assist civilian law enforcement authorities for the presidential inauguration. Next, at the top in the center, is a jacket of a very appropriately titled book just published by one of our former Alaska Air Guard pararescue jumpers. In the top left photo, you'll see our Lieutenant Governor with former Sergeant First Class Wesley Aiken, who is also in the bottom left photo. So why does this gentleman get two photos? Because he's an example of the spirit of service we all wish to emulate. Sergeant Aiken has served the citizens of Alaska for over 70 years. His journey began in 1943 when he joined the Alaska Territorial Guard, and he served next in the Alaska Army National Guard from 1953 to 1970, and now at 90 years young, he continues his service as a trained tribal veterans representative to the veterans and families of Utqiagvik. At the bottom left is a, excuse me, the bottom right is a gathering of the next generation of military leaders who we recently challenged to help lead our initiative in what I call ethical fitness. And I'd like to pass the microphone to our State Command Chaplain, Colonel Cook, who's going to tell you what we are embarking on and why.
Thank you, ma'am. Senator Costello, Representative Kawasaki, and honored members. Following the times of troubles experienced by the National Guard, Alaska National Guard, before the end of 2014, General Hummel devised a plan to ensure the proficiency and effectiveness of the military professionalism and ethical fitness within our organization. Through her contacts at the national level, she met and communicated with Rear Admiral Margaret Klein, who headed the Secretary of Defense Office of Military Professionalism at the Pentagon. General Hummel charged me to lead a team from our organization to be trained at that office. Four of us, to include our senior enlisted leader, Chief Master Sergeant Paul Nelson, attended a week-long training at the Secretary of Defense Office of Military Professionalism a year ago. Since that time, we have created military professionalism and ethical fitness curriculum, engaged numerous opportunities to share the material and entertain dialogical interchanges with personnel of all ranks, and 1 month ago, we conducted a formal two-day training for all of our E6, that's Army Guard Staff Sergeants and Air Guard Technical Sergeants, and we also had some guests from the active duty as well as the Naval Militia. Non-commissioned officers are the backbone of the organization, and E6s are in the middle of the pack. They influence everyone from the lowest to highest ranks. Our objectives were to get them engaged as young leaders, to call us all to meet professional and ethical standards, to be the best professional military culture anywhere. The living and learning of military professionalism never rests. Abiding in service values, just like exercising for physical fitness, takes daily discipline and effort.
Thank you, Chaplain. So the Army and Air National Guard continue to train, deploy, operate, and return as part of our federal mission sets. My mission partners who talked before previously discussed many of these exercises and operations that you see listed, from the ICEX 200 miles north of Prudhoe Bay to continuing our robust relationship with training the Mongolian Armed Forces for peacekeeping operations during conquest, to Operation Deep Freeze, through which we supported the National Science Foundation efforts in Antarctica. Our operations of the Alaska National Guard are literally covering the globe. Our cargo aircraft continue to move people and equipment around the world. The slide shows that we moved 4,000 personnel over the last year, but to be exact, only 3,000 of those landed with us because we just can't seem to keep General Owens' personnel from jumping out of our planes. In addition to supporting exercises around the globe, we continue to deploy soldiers and airmen in support of the war fight. Our Alaska National Guard is not solely a 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year outfit. You can see from the bottom left there the 24/7 missions we conduct that work to keep Alaska safe every second of every day. Next, please. So as you well know, and has been discussed earlier today, Alaska is what makes the U.S. an Arctic nation. So we recognized that the National Guard, and specifically the Alaska National Guard, was underrepresented on Department of Defense working groups that were charged with crafting policy for operations in the Arctic. My very assertive joint staff has secured membership on the Office of the Secretary of Defense's Arctic Strategy Working Group, and also we have a seat at the table at U.S. Northern Command's Arctic Capabilities Working Group. That way we can make sure that we're recognized as a stakeholder in the Arctic, and our interests will be taken into account when crafting policies and identifying military requirements. In January, we also hosted representatives from 9 other state National Guards at Fort Wainwright and up at Utqiagvik for the first ever National Guard Arctic Interest Summit. That's the photo in the middle there that kind of looks like the United Nations. At this meeting, we signed the Arctic Interest Council Charter for the National Guard. This organization will be the primary developer for the National Guard Arctic capabilities and policy across the country. Next. So emergency management capacity. This line of effort is what truly makes the National Guard and the rest of the organized militia special. The National Guard has a federal, but it also has a state mission, and no other component has this requirement. That's what makes us different. Our state defense force and our naval militia are Alaskans dedicated to helping Alaskans, especially in their greatest time of need. One of our major accomplishments over the last year was the complete revision and modernizing of the fundamental documents for both the State Defense Force and the Naval Militia. These organizations now have better defined standards and policies to support the execution of their state mission sets. Both of these groups, along with the National Guard counterparts, participated in last year's wildfire response and the Homeland Security exercise Alaska Shield. We also continue assisting our partner nation, Mongolia, with developing their own emergency management capacity through the earthquake readiness exercise Gobi Wolf 2016 and a number of bilateral engagements. Reaching out to the multiple communities of Alaska is one of the most satisfying missions that we have. And getting to honor the service of fellow Alaska service members is hands down the best part of that. This past year, we named the Kotzebue Army Aviation Operations Facility after former Adjutant General and the Army's first Alaska Native two-star general, John Schaefer. The plaque shown in the bottom right photo is now displayed proudly on this facility, letting all who enter know that it is named after Kip Kenya. I'd like to direct your attention to the volunteer hours listed on the slide, 30,000 hours. That's a conservative estimate and doesn't accurately capture all of the untold volunteer hours your organized militia puts into serving its communities and state. One thing we participate in every year is Operation Santa Claus. It's a tremendous experience to be part of a large community effort to visit rural communities during the Christmas holidays. Seating is always limited, but one way to get on board is to volunteer and help pack gift boxes and wrap presents. If you have interest volunteering for Op Santa, like Lieutenant Governor Malott did, please let us know, and we promise we won't make you dress like an elf. So in conclusion, I want to share a story, a hypothetical day that demonstrates what your Alaska Organized Militia does and is prepared to do every day in concert with our mission partners. So here it goes. The airmen of our 176th Air Defense Squadron at J-Bear detect an incursion into Alaskan airspace. This leads to the launch of an intercept flight by the 11th Air Force. As that F-22 pilot launches, she knows that if she needs to refuel in flight, our KC-135 from Eielson Air Force Base will take care of it. If she has an emergency and she has to punch out of her aircraft, the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, manned by Alaska National Guardsmen, will know where she went down. And our Combat Search and Rescue Triad from the Alaska National Guard, HC-130 aircraft, HH-60 helicopters, and the Pararescue Jumpers, or PJs, are prepared to come save her life. Meanwhile, it's a really bad day. A bad actor in North Korea launches an intercontinental ballistic missile against the United States. Our 213th Space Warning Squadron at CLEAR detects and tracks that missile while notifying our Army National Guard soldiers of the 49th Missile Defense Battalion over at Fort Greely to launch interceptors to destroy it. And on this really bad day, a wildfire threatening our communities will have the remaining men and women of the organized militia poised and ready to respond in support of the local incident commander. I know you're proud, as I am, of these dedicated Alaskans, your Alaska National Guard, your organized militia, who are always ready and always there. Pursuant to your questions, and on behalf of all my mission partners, we want to thank you for inviting us today.
Thank you, Major General Hummel and Colonel Cook. We do have at least one question from Nelson Angapak, who is online. Mr. Angapak, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. Major General Hummel, I want to thank you for your time and service, and in particular, those programs you outlined that impacts rural Alaska. My question is, about 2006, 160 Alaska Native members of the National Guard were deployed to Kuwait to provide logistical support for our troops in Iraq. Some of those were redeployed to Afghanistan and other battlefield theaters. Some of them came back with issues dealing with what they experienced out there. What kind of reintegration program is there in place to assist these young men as they make an effort to get back to the village life? Thank you.
Hello, sir. This is Chaplain Cook, and I'm going to answer part of your question before we turn it over to General Hummel, but I want to let you know that we have a multifaceted care team through family programs, as well as the chaplaincy. We have chaplains in every battalion, every position now. We also, and they're all trained in a variety of interventions, as well as we have full-time psychological help through our psychological care team. They meet once a month, and they coordinate, and they make sure that we have a wide net and a net that is not torn in any place that anybody can fall through the cracks. The one thing that we do ask of all soldiers and family members and community members as well is that we cannot, we're not clairvoyant. So if we don't know there's a problem, then we cannot respond to a problem. And so if at all a community member or a family member or even a service member feels need to reach out to our care team, we can respond very quickly and very efficiently and effectively. And the general also reminded me we have the Forget Me Not Coalition, which actually covers all service members, active duty and reserve component throughout the state of Alaska in all branches. And through that coalition, there are services across the state, people, businesses, faith communities, health communities, mental health communities as well, that have joined this Forget Me Not Coalition and have promised that they would be able to serve and aid service members and families, again, of all components and all branches of our service. And a lot of that is coordinated through the National Guard because we're always here, and so that we can keep the continuity going.
Mr. Engepak, this is Lori Hummel. First of all, I want to thank you for your advocacy and your service for Alaska's veterans, and congratulations on your appointment as a public member of the Joint Armed Services Committee. The chaplain has covered very well some of the support services that we have in place, but I would like to add that we understand that there are 75,000 plus veterans living in Alaska who have upwards of 150,000 dependent family members. And the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs includes our Office of Veterans Affairs, which is headed by Verdi Bowen. And it's a small shop, but we do Herculean work in trying to reach out to all veterans all across the state, those who are more resilient and doing well, and those who are less resilient need extra care and extra support. We also have a large number, and it's somewhere north of 100, trained tribal veterans representatives who have been trained by our Office of Veterans Affairs to help veterans negotiate the labyrinth maze of veterans programs. And, you know, as a veteran myself, I can say it's very daunting to figure your way out and figure your way into the system and how to negotiate for those entitlements and benefits that you have earned. And so we have folks who are your trained neighbors who are willing to go every step of the way with the veterans to make sure that we leave no soldier, airman, sailor, Marine, or Coast Guardsman behind. Does this answer your question, sir?
Yes, ma'am. And veteran to veteran, thank you very much for your service.
Yours as well, sir.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Engepak. Seeing no further questions, I just wanted to once again thank each of our commanders of the military branches that serve in Alaska, Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach, Major General Brian Owens, Rear Admiral Michael McAllister, and, of course, Major General Lori Hummel. Wanted to thank you for being here, and I think I can say on behalf of the entire committee that we appreciate your service to our country and our state. And we have not scheduled a further meeting at this point, but Co-Chair Costello and I will discuss a meeting time and try and get together with members of your staff. I want to remind the press that these four commanders will be available at a press conference in roughly 8 minutes downstairs on the second floor at the speaker's chambers. So at this time at 13:07, I adjourn today's meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee. Thank you.